From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No stranger to boundaries, Salman Rushdie has crossed every sort of line, a partitioned homeland, a forced exile, a death sentence. He's confronted the hate-filled stare of religious extremism and lived to write about it, even from New York City. In his new collection of essays, Step Across This Line, Salman Rushdie brings his intimate novelist's eye to Islam, American foreign policy, culture, and the arts in a fearful time. He dives into The Wizard of Oz and Kashmir, Arthur Miller, and the attacks on America. And he delves deep into the meaning of global frontiers and how the crossing of borders, of countries, of language, of imagination challenges and changes us all. September 11th, writes Salman Rushdie, has become itself a borderline. We all crossed a frontier that day, he writes, an invisible boundary between the imaginable and the unimaginable, and it turned out to be the unimaginable was real. In this hour, we step over old lines and take an intimate look at today's world with the celebrated novelist Salman Rushdie. What frontiers do you see the world crossing today? What boundaries? And how are we changed in the crossing? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is the author Salman Rushdie. His acclaimed novels include Midnight's Children, The Satanic Verses, The Moor's Last Sigh, and The Ground Beneath Her Feet. His new book is Step Across This Line, Collected Nonfiction, 1992 to 2002. Good evening and welcome, Salman Rushdie.
Hello, nice to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you with us. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book in 10 years of your essays and columns and lectures. It was just fantastic.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome, and thanks for the book. I thought it might be great to start off with just a little bit of you and your voice, and if you'd be good enough, the top of an essay entitled A Dream of Glorious Return. This was on heading back to India, and I think it was written in June 2000. Could you read just a little bit of that for us?
Sure. Here's the beginning. I have left India many times. The first time was when I was 13 and a half and went to boarding school in Rugby, England. My mother didn't want me to go, but I said I did. I flew west excitedly in January 61, not really knowing that I was taking a step that would change my life forever. A few years later, my father, without telling me, suddenly sold Windsor Villa, our family home in Bombay. The day I heard this, I felt an abyss open beneath my feet. I think that I never forgave my father for selling that house, and I'm sure that if he hadn't, I would still be living in it. Since then, my characters have frequently flown west from India, but in novel after novel, their author's imagination has returned to it. This, perhaps, is what it means to love a country, that its shape is also yours, the shape of the way you think and feel and dream, that you can never really leave.
Author, novelist, and essayist Salman Rushdie, reading one essay from his great new collection, Step Across This Line. Salman Rushdie, I was struck by your line, this perhaps is what it means to love a country, that its shape is also yours, the shape of the way you think and feel and dream, that you can never really leave. As you know from your current life and observation in Manhattan of the United States, Americans are very much at grips with this issue right now of exactly what the American character is, what the challenges are to it, and what has to be kept and what maybe even left behind as we confront a new world. How do you look out on your American neighbors these days?
Well, you know, I have to make a distinction between America, which is a huge place, much of which I don't know so much about, and New York City, which is you know, a wonderful city where I have made a new home for myself. And certainly the experience of the last year in New York has been, you know, obviously a kind of strange and burdened and at times very sad experience. And having just gone through the anniversary of those terrible attacks, I mean, that was a dark and difficult day for us here. So I think what I'd learned actually myself for myself from those terrible days was how deeply I have come to love this place. I mean, I felt a kind of domestic sense of violation that somebody came and, and broke my house.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, looking at the depth of my own feeling is a way of learning that after a lifetime of having come unstuck from various places, I seem to have got stuck here.
But you've paid a lot of attention to the American character, even if through your neighbors in New York and through the literature and history of America, you write about
the American fascination with frontiers, the way the frontier has yep. been mythologized, eulogized, even taken well beyond the reality in American thinking over many decades. And you make the frontier the central metaphor of the title essay or lectures of your book. What is it about frontiers that we're facing now and the American notion of frontier that you're trying to lead us to understand here?
Well, the American notion, you know, I studied history at university and I studied American history quite, amongst other things. And I remember reading the famous frontier thesis of the American historian Frederick Jackson Turner, mm-hmm. In which he, to put it simply, says that the movement of the frontier across the landmass of North America, you know, this snaking line heading towards the West, became the defining, shaping force of American character, measuring itself against the unknown, overcoming it. The frontier became like the line between the present and the future, and America saw its future across that frontier and would, could always move towards it. So it had a sense of moving towards a glorious goal. Mm. Many historians have subsequently tried to knock holes in the frontier thesis, and indeed it's possible to do so. But that central idea of it, I think, still holds true, that the American people did define their character as being something that was tested against a border that was always being pushed outwards. And that's something with which I felt a great personal affinity, because I think it's a way in which I've always defined the role of the writer, the role of the artist, is to go to the edge, to go to the frontier and push outwards, to try and not to stay in the safe ground in the middle, which is familiar and everybody knows it very well, mm-hmm. but to go to the borderline, to go to the borderline and try and push that further in order to increase the sum total of what it is possible to feel and to think.
It's been a long time, though, since the American frontier was the Hollywood version, mm-hmm. and that's clearly not the frontier you're describing anymore. It seems as though you're pulling into focus a new kind of frontier and laying down a challenge for Americans, and for that matter, for all the world.
Yes, for all of us.
To risk this new frontier, to take it, you use the image of the first life crawling up out of the sea to live on land. That's a radical frontier you're talking about. What's the nature of the frontier or frontiers or challenges, to put it another way, that we're looking at now?
Well, the frontier has become, to put it simply, it's full of holes. You know, it's no longer a line which firmly demarcates one place from another. This is partly because of migration, because of how many of us have come from one place to another. I mean, after all, that's part of the joy of New York City, is that people have come here from all over the world across various frontiers, you know, stepping across all sorts of lines. And their collective, the sum of all those stories, all those experiences, all those journeys becomes the flavor of the city and makes it the great city that it is. So partly the frontier is a demolished concept. You know, now the world is permeable. You know, things flow from one place to another as they didn't before.
This is the globalized sponge full of holes world.
Yeah, but it's not just globalization. It's also the way in which we physically move across the world, as well as the way in which our ideas, our music, moves across the world, and of course the way in which our products move across the world. So that's the reality of the modern world, and it ain't going away. You know, the world is not going to deglobalize, you know, anytime soon. So that's the thing to come into grips with. And I think there are things about it which I've always found to be very exciting. I've always myself found the movement of people to offer huge new possibilities and richnesses to the societies they come to. But of course, as we've seen graphically demonstrated in this country in the last 12 months, that frontier being full of holes obviously also brings with it great dangers. People can fly airplanes through those holes and ram them into tall buildings and kill thousands of people. Mm.
You clearly describe the way Americans took that hit, but you're also very aware of the way in which America, especially with its almost unique relationship with the frontier, with its intense mythology of the frontier, can be intimidating, frightening to the rest of the world. When Americans see a frontier, they want to cross it. You say when the rest of the world looks at how Native Americans on the frontier were treated,
yeah.
and they not themselves see themselves as the new American frontier, and it looks menacing.
Well, I think this is the most painful aspect of the conversation that the world needs to have with America and that perhaps America needs to have with itself, which is that, you know, there are, it seems to me, two different ideas that people mean when they say America. And those two ideas have less and less in common with each other. One is the America that you experience when you come to the United States, when you find an incredibly free society, a society with all kinds of pleasures and possibilities and potential and richness and depth, and, you know, a genuinely democratic and in many ways very admirable society. The other America is what the word America means in many places of the world, where the only experience they have of America is that of the exercise of American power. And often that has, let's say, put a lot of people's noses out of joint. What I've been trying to argue is that, especially in this world in which America is so much the dominant force in the world, where American influence is greater than any nation has ever achieved in the history of the world, perhaps, it becomes very important, I think, that when America acts outside its own frontiers in the rest of the world, it should act according to those same values and principles which Americans hold dear and which they believed to be under attack last year, and which are the reason that people value the United States. So that's to say, principles of freedom and democracy and so on, and a kind of ethical approach to society. When America moves away from those, as it sometimes does in foreign policy, when it, for reasons of expediency, shacks up with this or that dictator, for example, it makes it harder for America to make the case that it's acting on behalf of democracy and freedom. So that's what I'm saying. There's sometimes a discrepancy between the values that America seeks to cherish and defend and the way in which America's leaders behave in the rest of the world.
You say the frontier is a wake-up call. At the frontier, things get stripped down, and we can't ignore the truth. Is this the truth that you've seen in the last year as we face a cruel frontier of globalization?
Well, I think, you know, I think I've one thing I should say, I mean, I take great exception in these essays to those people who tried to blur what seemed to me to be two quite separate things. Mm-hmm. One is whatever criticisms one may have of this or that foreign policy of America, and the other is the discourse and language and procedures of terrorism. These two things got mixed up, and there were people who were very quick to say, to put it crudely, that America got what it deserved. There was a certain degree of really very upsetting commentary of that kind, even amongst people who should be America's friends in Western Europe and in Britain. So that seemed to me to be nauseating and wrong, because the Bin Laden gang, after all, was not, in my view, acting to right the world's injustices. It was making a very reprehensible grab for power, and its purpose was the Talibanization of the planet, you could say, you know.
Is that the truth we found at this frontier?
I think that's one of the truths. I mean, I think it was, I think, shocking to many people in this country, including me, that the enemy was capable of hitting so hard, so close to home. I don't think any of us thought that it could happen. That's what I meant when I said that you know, what happened here was that the unimaginable was the thing that became real. The imaginable was what was false. The unimaginable was the truth. That, I think, has forced all of us to look again at what we think about the world we live in. And I think it poses, amongst the many challenges that it sets up, is how shall we live with this knowledge? Shall we live by making our society less free? Shall we live by making it more suspicious, more intrusive, less open, if you like, more discriminatory against this or that group? Or shall we hold true to the principles that were the things that we valued and they were attacking in the first place?
The principles that brought us here. Salman Rushdie, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with author Salman Rushdie about frontiers, conflict, and the road ahead. What frontiers do you see the world crossing today? What boundaries? And how are we changed in the crossing? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Salman Rushdie about frontiers and conflict and the road ahead. He's got a new book out, Step Across This Line. It's his collected nonfiction of the last 10 years, 1992 to 2002. Do you feel America retreating behind walled frontiers, walled borders, physical and mental, or engaging the world as it is? What frontiers do you see the world crossing today, and how are we changed in that crossing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Salman Rushdie, I wondered if you'd be good enough to read us just a bit from the title essay or lecture of your new book, Step Across This Line, where you talk about dreams and responsibilities, dreams and irresponsibility.
Mm-hmm. In dreams begin responsibilities. The way we see the world affects the world we see. As our ideas of female beauty change, so we see different sorts of women as beautiful. As our ideas of healthy living change, so we begin to look at the things we eat differently. Our dreams of our own and our children's future shape the everyday judgments we make about work, about people, about the world that either enables or obstructs those dreams. Daily life in the real world is also an imagined life. The creatures of our imagination crawl out from our heads, cross the frontier between dream and reality, between shadow and act, and become actual. Imagination's monsters do the same thing. The attack on the World Trade Center was essentially a monstrous act of the imagination, intended to act upon all our imaginations, to shape our own imaginings of the future. It was an iconoclastic act in which the defining icons of the modern, the world-shrinking airplanes and those soaring secular cathedrals, the tall buildings, were rammed into each other in order to send a message that the modern world itself was the enemy and would be destroyed. It may seem unimaginable to us, but to those who perpetrated this crime, the deaths of many thousands of innocent people were a side issue. Murder was not the point. The creation of a meaning was the point. The terrorists of September 11 and the planners of that day's events behaved like perverted, but in another way, brilliantly transgressive performance artists, hideously innovative, shockingly successful, using a low-tech attack to strike at the very heart of our high-tech world. In dreams begin irresponsibilities, too.
Salman Rushdie, reading from the title essay of his new book, Step Across This Line. Salman Rushdie, we value you for many reasons. It is an indescribable pleasure to read your work, but not least because you have a foot in the world that we know well and in another world, in an Islamic world in part. This dream that you describe in this passage as beginning or leading to irresponsibility, help us understand it. What is the Islamist dream that took those planes to those towers?
Well, the problem with radical Islam, with what is beginning to be called Islamism, the politicized fanatical wing of Islam, is that it seeks to bring about a vanished world, the world, if you like, of 7th century desert Arabia. A culture which actually may never have existed in the way that they now dream it. So a kind of fantasy of the past. They seek to bring that back into being by the use of the methodology and the weapons of the present. That's to say, by using, you know, the Bin Laden gang uses email. They use computer technology a great deal to communicate. They go to internet cafes and get online to talk to each other. They're using much of the apparatus of the ultra-modern.
What is that so seductive about that 7th century history or vision or myth?
Well, for a start, it's extremely male. It looks at a world in which people know their place. You know, men are on top and women are underneath. But mostly, it's a world of certainty. It's a world in which every aspect of life is fixed and set in stone. You know how to do everything as long as you follow the rules. So it's a way of saying, here are rules for everything. And in a world in which, actually, people feel very uncertain a great deal of the time, the world seems a place which doesn't have those kinds of certainties anymore. The appeal of this, I guess, speaking as somebody for whom it's extremely unappealing, mm-hmm. Is that kind of those simple, absolute verities, you know, and that you can just live by.
And that are not American.
And that they're very much the antithesis of what it was that this country was about. Which, mm-hmm. I mean, this country, after all, began as a flight, as a flight from an older civilization in order to make a new world.
That dream, that Islamist dream, has turned out to be very destructive from an American perspective and from the perspective of much of Islam, we're told. But turn the globe for us. Look at American dreams. In dreams, you say, we shape reality. What reality are American dreams shaping today, and is it healthy?
Well, let's look at some of the more enjoyable side of this first. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the culture, both high culture and popular culture of America, has had an enormous impact on the rest of the world. I mean, I, as a writer, was probably more shaped by my reading of American literature than just about any other literature I can think of.
Not to mention Wizard of Oz, the movie, as we read in the beginning essay.
Yeah, I mean, The Wizard of Oz is a movie that I saw in India when I was 10 years old or so, and I went home from it and wrote my first short story, which was unoriginally called Over the Rainbow.
But you conclude that essay, you say, in the end, ceasing to be children, we all become magicians without magic, exposed conjurers, with only our simple humanity to get us through. We are the humbugs now. That includes the United States. What's the humbug part here? What's the dream?
I mean, there I'm writing not about nations, but about moving across the frontier from the child to the parent. You know?
Which is something universal, something we all share.
To the child, the parent is magical, omnipotent, etc. And then, you know, you grow up and discover they're not. They're just, you know, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. You know, it's just, we end up being the Wizard of Oz. We end up not having the magical powers that our children originally believe us to have.
Salman Rushdie, I may have taken you off the beat there, and I didn't mean to, but yeah. I want to also get your sense. So we hear you, and we're glad that the American dream projects much that is positive into the world.
Yeah.
Fill the picture out for us.
I grew up with rock and roll music, you know, and I was 9 years old when Bill Haley sang Rock Around the Clock.
But are the dreams, I guess I'm asking, and I don't want to rain on that parade because it's beautiful and we all love it, but are the dreams that are in effect destructive also come out of that American dream?
I think there's the problem of power. I mean, essentially, that's the aspect of all the great superpowers that was very problematic for the rest of the world. I mean, in the days of the Soviet Union, America and the Soviet Union, you know, had their spheres of influence, and there was a great deal of pushing and pulling between these two superpowers, and their effect on the world was not necessarily at all positive. There were places that felt crushed under the Soviet yoke. There were places that felt crushed under the power of America. Since the end of the Cold War, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, America's loss of an adversary has meant that American power has exponentially increased in the world. And there are aspects of that which are very worrying. I have found some of the American administration's unwillingness to, as it were, to respect any treaty, very problematic. The idea that the world should not be able to limit America by getting America to sign a treaty with it, whether that's about the environment or whatever else it might be. I think it's been very alarming to see this kind of go-it-alone spirit surging back into the very highest corridors of American power. You know, the world is an interpenetrated and collaborative place. It's not a world in which one can easily go it alone without doing some damage.
Salman Rushdie, stand by. There's a lot of callers who want to join our conversation. Listeners, do you recognize the world Salman Rushdie describes? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Brian's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask a little bit more about this rejection, it seems to me, or this turning away from the international order. It scares me to see the American president rejecting international treaties and, in fact, international norms, and I'm wondering if you think that this is a temporary thing, or do you see a movement away from what you could call the sort of the extension of sort of Western tradition? You know, the United Nations in some ways is an extension of democracy that's happened since the Enlightenment, and I guess, are we moving away from that? And what principles, or maybe principles and dreams can't be equated, but it seems to me that with power comes responsibility, and what I see is a turning away from all principles, that while we talk about democracy, we talk about the rule of law, the things that I hear our president talking about are in direct conflict and a rejection of that. And I guess I'm wondering if you have a broader perspective on this.
Salman Rushdie.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy with much of what you say. I think one of the interesting things that happened after the attacks on America was that this particular American administration, which had begun in quite a kind of isolationist way, as you say, repudiating a number of treaties and so on, was forced by those terrible circumstances to seek to build a global coalition or some kind of international coalition anyway in order to make possible the campaign against those who had perpetrated these attacks. And so the administration was actually forced into a collaborationist model, which was not its natural way of being, it seems. And that coalition was created, and that campaign was executed, you know, largely successfully, not completely successfully. I mean, we don't, you know, but largely. I had hoped, I must say, that as the Bush people saw the benefits that they had gained from that collaborative procedure, that they would begin to re-engage with the world and extend that principle of collaboration to many other areas. I regret that has not seemed to be the case.
Our caller Brian sees almost the Bush administration substituting the Wild West principles for the Western tradition as he has it. Do you see that?
Well, what I worry about is that, and I thought this a lot on the anniversary of September 11, that the deep feelings that those atrocities aroused in us are now being used to justify actions in other parts of the world which have kind of nothing to do with September 11. I don't believe that the issue of Saddam Hussein is related to the issue of al-Qaeda and the attacks on America. And I worry that the emotion unleashed by this event is being diverted, in my view, incorrectly into these new areas, which I also find pretty alarming, I have to say.
Brian, thank you for your call. Ravi's calling from Boston. Hi, Ravi. You're on the air.
Hi, it's a pleasure. I wanted to ask Mr. Rushdie to comment on the hypothesis that the world would be a better place if we had more democracy in the Islamic world. I'm sort of coming from a rather biased sample size of one. If I look at India, the president of the country, it seems like the Muslims have a voice out there, and it's not an extremist one. I mean, you can look at the arts, the sports. Mm-hmm. Azim Premji, the richest man in the country, is a software giant who's Muslim. So.
Are you holding India up as an example of democracy then, Ravi?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. I mean, it is a democracy, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. By any stretch of the imagination. So, mm-hmm.
Well, I have a great deal of... I mean, I agree with just about everything you say. I mean, I think it's... You know, there were a lot of Muslims, as you know, in the Indian subcontinent at the time of partition, who did not wish to live in a Muslim state, who chose to remain in India, preferring to be one community amongst many and to be Indians first, so to speak, and Muslims second or third or 17th.
Including eventually much of your own family.
Much of my own family. And certainly that was always, you know, my family was, I mean, yes, we are from an Indian Muslim background, but, you know, it was not a very religious family. Certainly my bit of it wasn't. But it is right that India has had Muslim presidents, it's had Muslim, cricket captains, it's had, you know, Muslims, Muslim movie stars often, and not necessarily limited to playing Muslim characters, but, you know, some of the biggest stars in India today are Muslim.
Salman Rushdie, I think Ravi is asking us to look then on into the Islamic world,
yeah,
and ask, why not there? Can it work?
Well, I mean, I think it's absolutely vital that Muslim countries develop democratic institutions. If you look around the Muslim world, you see dictatorships, military dictatorships, theological dictatorships. You see monarchies which are more or less absolute. You see secular, in the places like Iraq, you see secular tyrannies, which are like of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, which are really quite like the Soviet model.
Is there room for democracy? Is there a seedbed?
I mean, just ask the people, you know, go and ask the people in Iran now.
Then why don't we see it anywhere?
Well, exactly. In my view, it is the great contemporary failure of Muslim society, that it has failed to develop the institutions of free society, of a free society. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of people, commentators, say educators, politicians, journalists in the Muslim world who routinely blame the ills of the Muslim world on the West. And it seems to me that this needs to be turned around, and it's very important that these societies ask why they have failed to develop those institutions and what they can do about it.
Something intrinsic to Islam that's a problem here or not?
No, I think it's a historical moment, but I do think that when Islam becomes enmeshed in the business of politics, as it does in theocratic states like Iran, then the states become catastrophes. I mean, you know, look at Iran. Iran 30 years ago was an extremely wealthy nation that was the breadbasket of the region. It exported food to the country, to its neighboring countries. Now it has food riots because there's nothing in the shops. You cannot run a 21st century state according to medieval principles.
But it was also a police state run by the Shah when it
happened. It was, and I mean, I strongly opposed it. But look at the people, look at the forces that existed that fought against the Shah. There was a highly successful urban intelligentsia. There was a very highly developed trades union movement. There was a very powerful feminist movement. There were all kinds of things which you would see as being the apparatus of a sophisticated modern state, and they all allied with Khomeini and the mullahs to attack the Shah, and that's why the Shah fell.
If George Bush's hawks, if the hawks in the wings of the White House have their way and we reshuffle the regimes of the Middle East, is that a recipe for democracy or something else?
Well, I worry, one of the things that most worries me about the whole Iraqi project is the absolute uncertainty of what America wishes to replace Saddam Hussein with. Do they, for example, plan to keep the structure of the Ba'athist Party and put in simply a new strongman, you know, who would be, you know, as Roosevelt said about a different strongman in Nicaragua, you know, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Is that the plan, just simply to put our own son of a bitch in charge? Because that doesn't seem to me to be particularly beneficial to the people of Iraq.
Salman Rushdie, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with author Salman Rushdie about frontiers, conflict, and the road ahead. What frontiers do you see the world crossing today? What boundaries? And how are we changed in the crossing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with celebrated author, novelist, and essayist Salman Rushdie. He's out with a new book, Step Across This Line, collected nonfiction, 1992 to 2002. You can join the conversation as well. What great frontiers do we need to cross now? And what do you see through the eyes of Salman Rushdie? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Wendy's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Wendy. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
First of all, Tom, I just wanted to say that I so appreciate the voice that you bring to radio these days, and that's been a hole in my heart that I've missed for a couple of years, and I'm just really glad that you're on the air.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And for Salman Rushdie.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that you had mentioned that what America espouses and what it actually does, for instance, going to bed with dictators, is a potentially, in your words, a frontier, which I completely agree with. And I just see us as a collective country, as well as individuals, having to cross that abyss in absolute terms. We absolutely have to confront the fact that we say one thing and do another. And as an example of that, I was no fan of President Bill Clinton. However, I was rather bemused, shall I say, at people's reaction to the fact that the gentleman lied and cheated on his wife. And I was especially bemused because the statistics bear out that most married men, or a grand number of them, do that. And I said, you know, I think that this is a problem that we all have in the United States.
So what are the values that what are the values you're asking us to export now, Wendy?
To take a hard look inside and say, how can I integrate? How can we be a positive influence in the world going forward, and not backtrack on and backpedal on what we have always been, which is a country, as he said, of democracy and fairness and openness, and we are not acting in those ways.
Well, I think it's something that, you know, American citizens can affect very directly. I think, you know, the more of you demand of your leaders that they do act according to the values which you hold dear and which they are claiming to defend, the harder it will be for them to act otherwise. So I wanted to say one thing about Clinton, which really was an extremely beneficial side of his presidency, which was the relationship, the improvement in the relationship between India and the United States that he effected. You know, until Clinton's visit to India, historically, relations between India and the United States had never been very good. And one of the reasons for this is that during the Soviet Union, during those days, India had had quite close relationships with the Soviet Union, treaties and trade and economic agreements and so on. And that the United States, because of the Cold War attitudes, had therefore somewhat kept its political and economic and cultural distance from India. Clinton's visit was, I think impossible to overstate here how powerful that visit was in India. It was the first time in more than a generation that people in India began to think of the United States as a potential friend and ally and partner. So,
and you write, Salman Rushdie, about how important it is for the United States, for the world, to take seriously India's democracy. John Kenneth Galbraith, you quote, famously called it the greatest functioning anarchy.
Yeah.
There's something more than that, although there's that too.
Yeah, but I mean, India is the most extraordinary experiment in the age that followed the ending of the great empires. Here you have a country which, well, it's doubled in population in my lifetime. When I was young, it was around half a billion people. It's now over a billion people. Here you have a country of a billion people that has run an elective democracy based on universal adult suffrage from the beginning. And with the exception of a 2.5-year period in the mid-70s when Mrs. Gandhi suspended democratic rights, that has been an unbroken state of affairs, which if you look at the countries around India, not a single other country, you know, not China, not Pakistan, not Burma, none of them can boast anything like it.
So for tonight, we'll say bravo to India. But Salman Rushdie, what about Wendy's greater point, which is her concern that on balance, the U.S. export is not positive enough?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the activities of superpower diplomacy, and nowadays the United States is the only superpower, there is always much to criticize and deplore. And I think there is in the history of America's activities in many of the regions of the world. I would think at the moment in South America, the United States' attempt to force countries to obey very strict IMF rules in their monetary dealings is having a very destabilizing effect on a number of governments which the United States ought actually to be doing the opposite, to be shoring up. So I think, yes, there's always been, and I certainly have, many criticisms of America's foreign policy, but I can't ignore the fact that also America has given me personally and to many people a great deal of enrichment. So, you know, there's two sides to the question.
Wendy, thanks for your call. Salman Rushdie, you have a wonderful essay, or I guess it was a speech you delivered at Arthur Miller's, was it 80th? His 80th birthday.
Yes, his 80th birthday.
This is at the University of East Anglia.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about, you laud him for his insistence on the reality of the real and on the moral function of writing. Then you quote him saying, "The ultimate human mystery may not be anything more than the claims of us on clan and race, which may yet turn out to have the power, because they defy the rational mind, to kill the world." It's a very radical and disturbing perspective that makes the talk about exporting great values seem almost beside the point if we accept it.
Well, I think Miller is very good at drawing attention to the the harsh truths of human nature, which may, you know, we may be rather more primitive creatures than we like to think of ourselves as. But civilization is, that's what we did, that's what we have developed civilization for. It's there in order to clothe our baser instincts, our animal natures, our tribal and clannish, lusts in a more sophisticated, more tolerant, richer and deeper way of life. And that's what civilization is. And we have to fight for that and not to allow that baser nature, which is our nature as well, to win the day. And I think Miller would say exactly the same thing.
Gull's calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Hi, Gull. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question regarding U.S. role in basically world that as it's increasing and U.S. role is being a little bit sidelined by U.S. in some scenarios.
And the United Nations role being pushed aside by the U.S., you're saying?
Yes. And basically, U.S. is getting more and more powerful in terms of affecting countries' policies regarding economics or financial or being the defense. So what kind of system or infrastructure U.S. should develop to basically get this in place to develop itself as its major power so that it continues to have that role and also take major population of the world along its side?
Gull, thank you for your call. Salman Rushdie, here's this sort of contest that became almost explicit last week between the United Nations and the United States, as George Bush essentially said, you know, whistle or lose it. Where do you see the power, and where would you like to see the power?
Well, I think the United Nations has been weak of late. There's no question about it. And the United Nations has, been at times pushed around by the United States. There's no question of that either. I know, for instance, that during the extremely dangerous sort of close to nuclear conflict that developed between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, the United States, ironically with the backing of Russia, was preventing the Security Council from discussing the Kashmir issue. And when America, if the Security Council does not exist to discuss the possibility of a nuclear war between two member states of the United Nations, then what is it for, one might argue? You know, why should one have a Security Council if it's not going to take on board issues like that?
Salman Rushdie, our time is growing short, and before you go, I want to get one long read from you, if you'd be good enough. You wrote an essay in February 1999 on 10 years of the fatwa, the threat on your life after you wrote the satanic verses.
Yeah.
There may be something for Americans to learn in it now, I'm not sure, but if you'd be good enough to read that essay, we would be grateful.
Sure. Well, I would happily, since I wrote 3 years ago, wrote that essay, that story has come to a conclusion, but in February 1999 when I wrote it, this is how I felt. Yes, all right, on February the 14th, it will be 10 years since I received my unfunny Valentine. I admit to a dilemma. Ignore the politics, which I'd love to do, and my silence must look enforced or fearful. Speak, and I risk deafening the world to those other utterances, my books, written in my true language, the language of literature. I risk helping to conceal the real Salman behind the smoky, sulfurous Rushdie of the affair. I have led two lives, one blighted by hatred and caught up in this dire business which I'm trying to leave behind, and the life of a free man freely doing his work. Two lives, but none I can afford to lose, for one loss would end both. So I'll have my say, and because everybody loves an anniversary, no doubt much will be said elsewhere by the armies of bigotry and punditry. Let them volley and thunder. I'll speak of bookish things. When asked about the effect on my writing of the 10-year-long assault upon it, I've answered lightheartedly that I've become more interested in happy endings, and that as I've been told that my recent books are my funniest, the attacks have evidently improved my sense of humor. These answers, true enough in their way, are designed to deflect deeper inquiry. For how can I explain to strangers my sense of violation? It's as if men wielding clubs were to burst loudly into your home and lay it waste. They arrive when you're making love or standing naked in the shower or sitting on the toilet or staring in deep inward silence at the lines you've scrawled on a page. Never again will you kiss or bathe or shit or write without remembering this intrusion. And yet to do these things pleasurably and well, you must shut out the memory. And how to describe the damage? As perhaps a heaviness as something remembered from boarding school childhood. I wake and, lying in bed, find I can't move. My arms, legs, and head have grown impossibly weighty. Nobody believes me, of course, and all the children laugh. I can't go on, says Beckett's unnameable. I'll go on. A writer's injuries are his strengths, and from his wounds will flow his sweetest, most startling dreams. Amid the cacophony of the professionally opinionated and the professionally offended, may a voice still be heard celebrating literature, highest of arts, its passionate, dispassionate inquiry into life on earth, its naked journey across the frontierless human terrain, its fierce-minded rebuke to dogma and power, and its trespassers' fearless daring. In these years, I've met and been inspired by some of the world's bravest fighters for literary freedom. I recently helped set up a house for refugee writers in Mexico City. More than 20 cities already belong to this refuge city scheme, and was proud to be doing a little to ease the struggles of others in danger from intolerance. But as well as fighting the fight, which I will surely go on doing, I have grown determined to prove that the art of literature is more resilient than what menaces it. The best defense of literary freedoms lies in their exercise, in continuing to make untrammeled, uncowed books. So beyond grief, bewilderment, and despair, I have rededicated myself to our high calling. I'm conscious of shifts in my writing. There was always a tug of war in me between there and here, the pull of roots and of the road. In that struggle of insiders and outsiders, I used to feel simultaneously on both sides. Now I've come down on the side of those who, by preference, nature, or circumstance, simply do not belong. This unbelonging, I think of it as disorientation, loss of the East, is my artistic country now. Wherever my books find themselves, by a favored armchair, near a hot bath, on a beach, or in a late-night pool of bedside light, that's my only home. Life can be harsh, and for a decade, St. Valentine's Day has reminded me of that harshness. But these dark anniversaries of the appalling Valentine I was sent in 1989 have also been times to reflect upon the countervailing value of love. Love feels more and more like the only subject. It's reported that the remains of St. Valentine himself are to come out of hiding. Instead of the cardboard box in which they were ignominiously stored for years, they will have a reliquary in Glasgow's Roughneck Gorbals district. I like this image. The patron saint of fluffy romance discovers the gritty verities of life in the real world, while that world is enriched in turn by the flowering in its mean streets of love.
Salman Rushdie, reading from the essay that he wrote a decade after the fatwa called against him, when the fatwa had finally, essentially, gone behind you, Salman Rushdie.
Yes, thank goodness. The best thing to say about it is that it's over.
And post 9/11, love still the only subject?
More and more, I think. You know, I mean, the answer to hate is love.
Salman Rushdie, it's been an enormous pleasure. Thank you for your new book, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie, author of Midnight's Children, The Satanic Verses, and so many other novels, most recently now the author of Step Across This Line, Collected Nonfiction, 1992 to 2002. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...